Hello, you lanky Daniels. Welcome to the Blind Buy Podcast. I'm going to be keeping the introduction short because I have a very special podcast for you this week. I had a conversation with Professor Anna Abraham, who is a psychologist and neuroscientist with a specific interest in researching creativity. So we sat down and spoke all about creativity, but this isn't just a conversation about creativity, it's a conversation about creativity with an expert in creativity. And I'm doing this podcast as part of Creative Brain Week, which kicks off in Ireland this Friday. Creative Brain Week lasts from March the 12th to the 16th, which it was founded by Professor Ian Robertson, who asked me to do this and who set me up with the chat with Anna Abramson. So if you want to find out about Creative Brain Week, go to creativebrainweek.com. But just to let you know what it is, it's a series of online and in-person events which explore and celebrate how brain science and creativity collide. I believe this is their first year doing it, and it's a pioneering event that illustrates innovation at the intersection of arts and brain science, including creative approaches to health. So that sounds phenomenally interesting, and there's lots of events. So check out creativebrainweek.com. If you're around Dublin and you want to attend one of these events, or if you want to attend them online, I'm very happy to be doing this podcast as part of Creative Brain Week because it's something I'd like to see. I'm hugely interested in creativity and I'm an artist, but I'm also massively interested in psychology. So here we have something that mixes the two. I had a fantastic conversation with Anna Abraham. Just for you to know what to expect, we spoke about what creativity is, why everybody, all humans, should explore our creativity to benefit our mental health. We spoke at length about the Beatles documentary Get Back as a model for what the creative process is. We speak about creativity and neurodiversity, and we speak at length about research into what is creative flow and how do we achieve creative flow. What is the science saying about how to achieve creative flow? If you want to find out more about Anna's work, go to her website, annaabraham.com, to find out about her work and to find out about the book she's written about her research into creativity. This April, Anna is running the 2022 Torrance Festival of Ideas, which is an annual free online cultural festival which is open to the global community, where renowned experts across diverse fields of human enterprise share their creative ideas and innovative projects with the general public. I'd like to get straight into the chat now because this was quite a long interview. We spoke for 2 hours. I managed to edit it down to about 90 minutes, which isn't that long as podcasts go. Like, there's certain podcast interviews that can go on for 4 hours, but this is a 90-minute long interview. Which means you mightn't listen to it in one go. But if you're interested in creativity and psychology, this is the one for you. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this chat and I learned so much. So here you go, my chat with Professor Anna Abraham. Anna, thank you so much for coming on the podcast for a chat. So you're Professor Anna Abraham and you are a neuroscientist and a psychologist with a specific interest in studying creativity.
That's right, yes. And thank you for having me on this, sorry.
You're welcome. That area for me is, so I'm an artist, I'm a practicing artist across a few different disciplines, but I'm also someone who studied psychology. I was going to be a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. And this is an area I'm hugely interested in, but somewhere that I find it quite difficult to find information about creativity, creative people. Most of the stuff I know about is from a psychologist called Donald McKinnon.
Yeah.
And his mm-hmm. studies on creative flow. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I found, like even when I studied as an artist in college, like not necessarily mental health, but yeah, mental health. So here's the thing, I'm professionally creative, and in order for me to create art and to enter flow state regularly, I know that my self-esteem is very important, my levels of happiness are quite important, And I need to keep these things in check in order for me to create. Mm-hmm. Also, one thing I find with the art education system is art can sometimes be very, very serious. That's very true. Serious and lacking in fun and humor. And if I'm not engaged in playfulness and fun, then I'm not going to create. And yeah. There's this big gulf I find between, we'll say, psychology and art education. So I can't wait to have this chat. First question I have for you, Anna. What is creative flow?
That's a good first question. I'm very interested in what you just said because I also entered psychology in order to be a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. I went in to study creativity by looking at it from a sort of mental illness angle. So everything you said was quite interesting. What is creative flow? Flow experiences in general have a number of things in common, right? It's a sense of losing a sense of time and space, being mm-hmm. extremely focused, being finding something rewarding in and of itself. So the experience itself is called autotelic. So it feels extremely rewarding. Mm-hmm. It's a very strange sense of being somehow hyper-focused, but mm-hmm. it's still effortless. Mm-hmm. And it usually occurs when there's some sort of kind of perfect balance between your abilities at that given point and the challenge that you're facing at that given point. Now, this is true of all flow experience, regardless of whether it's a creative or non-creative endeavor. Mm-hmm. When you're doing something creative, I know that a lot of musicians always talk about how they want to sort of reach the stage when they're jamming, right? Creating music is fun, but somehow there's something about creating music while experiencing flow that's in some ways transports you, is magical. It's that sense of transportation that people want, where they feel that they're reaching inner parts of themselves that would be mm-hmm. inaccessible if you were trying to go about it consciously. And that there's something sort of revelatory and truthful about it. And so we recognize these moments as being just, you know, very special, and we want to keep going there. In the case of creativity, of course, it's about creating a response or generating an idea and by idea, I mean very loosely, whether it's a musical sequence or whether it's a phrase or whether it's any kind of expression that is novel. Ultimately, it's about originality. So it's about novelty mm-hmm. and uniqueness, unusualness to yourself, ultimately. But also with that comes a sense of finding it extremely satisfying yeah. that you know that it's like you get some piece of the puzzle that you didn't know could fit. So it's a kind of very strange experience to go through. And in periods of flow, you can get there, of course, without being in a mm-hmm. flow experience. But there's something about, especially artists or people, even scientists, who talk about revelations that come to them while experiencing flow mm-hmm. that feels particularly insightful, you know, that feels like, oh my, I've got so much further than I would normally have done. I got there like at warp speed suddenly.
Yeah.
So there's something about it that flow in the case of creativity is very, it's always special, I think, but it's something that I think all creative persons, I think anyone who's trying to be creative aspires to get to that sort of experience, that sort of phenomenology of flow, because you feel very at one with yourself at that moment.
And so for me personally, like, the feeling of flow is probably the most important thing in my life, mm-hmm. even kind of more important than relationships with people.
Yeah.
Like it's so beautiful and so intense that if I go for long periods without it, my mental health is impacted. And my mental health has a relationship with how often I can experience flow. And so I have a few different types of flow. When you were speaking there about musical flow, I can achieve musical flow, but I feel that as a bodily flow. It's mm-hmm. it's still flow, and I'm still not on this planet. It doesn't feel like I'm on this planet, and I'm still creating at an ability that I couldn't do if I wasn't in flow. And it feels amazing. But then there's the flow that I experience if I'm writing a short story, if I'm writing a book. Mm-hmm. That's what I would call, for my experience of that, is cognitive flow. And that's way, way more intense. I've I've written short stories, and when I'm in full flow, it literally feels like I'm sitting in a cinema watching a film that was made just for me, and I'm not creating it, it's being revealed to me. And if I'm not religious, but if I was, I would genuinely believe that this is supernatural, this is spiritual. Because sometimes I'll enter flow for about an hour, write a story, then the story is finished, and I can't believe I made it. I can't believe that I came up with those words on that page. I can't believe that that plot arrived. It feels like it already existed and I found it. That's what the experience of it feels like. And it's the most beautiful feeling in the world. And I know when I create and I enter flow state, the piece of work that I've made is something that I'd be very, very happy with. And then it's frightening afterwards. Here's the thing with flow is flow is so intense that you can be scared that you'll never get it again. Mm-hmm. And then that can, like, the biggest barrier I find to entering flow is the fear of failure. If I'm afraid of failing, if I'm being very egotistic in my thinking, I won't enter flow. And the only way that I can enter flow is when I engage in play for the sake of play. Like when I was a child, I used to play with Lego. And when I'd play with Lego, I wasn't trying to make anything nice. I was simply doing Lego for the sake of Lego. And if I enter a creative state with that attitude, and that requires a good self-esteem, good mental health, sufficient rest, and most importantly, no ego and no fear of failure. Like sometimes I'll try to fail. If I try to fail, that will help me enter flow better. And by which I mean, if I'm sitting down to create and my mind is saying, that's a shit idea, that's a terrible idea, then I won't enter flow. So sometimes an idea will come into my head and my mind will go, that's a shit idea. So what I do is I try and make that shit idea work. And then what I've done is I've made the failure my friend, and all of a sudden this terrible idea has turned into something that I'm very, very happy with because I entered flow.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, there's so much that you said there that, and you mentioned Donald McKinnon at the start,
yeah.
Who sort of pointed out this sort of distinction between the open mode and the closed mode, right? And essentially, well, he and many others, and I suppose in modern times, the comedian and writer John Cleese is the one who's brought this to everybody's attention again, is that playfulness is absolutely central to, like, just not taking yourself seriously is so important in to become uninhibited is necessary for all of those associations to become wackier, zanier, take you places that are unusual. You know, it's sort of like saying, well, if you go for a walk, you can go down the path that was created for you, and we're very, you know, we're sort of trained to do so, aren't we? Like it's a civilized thing to do. And but if you're being playful, like kids are, they run into the woods and they do what they want. They just follow where their curiosity is. They see something, they hear something, and they just go. And it leads you down. You will discover more about the forest you are trying to walk through and experience if you go off the track, right? So you'll notice more things.
But also you must have a feeling of safety.
Yes, yes, that's true, right? So, and so it's the thing about flow that's kind of, if for one thing, you have to feel safe in yourself, for one thing, in terms of where your mind will lead you. You have to sort of feel convinced about your process, you know, that I will, I don't know, shut myself off from the world for an hour or two. And do what you said about letting go of your ego, but that's probably the most critical thing, because, and especially, and I wonder really if it's worse now when we're in an age where everyone's sort of showing and telling everything, right? This sort of emphasis is there, and it's very hard to say, well, do it for its own sake, you know? So when this is the hardest thing to, even when people come to, you know, people like myself to say, well, how do you become more creative? And part of it is just saying, well, you have to do things that are not necessarily useful. You have to learn to not, we've just sort of brought up to think about time as a resource that is precious, yes, that you don't waste, that everything is in measurable, quantifiable terms, you know? And it's very hard to break away from that and say, just sit down and try to get bored. Don't look at your phone. Do something aimless. Push yourself to a point where you're actually, you know, you go past being this insecurity of saying, oh my God, am I being absolutely useless here, to really saying, screw that. I'm enjoying this, and I'm allowing my, it's almost like saying, well, you fit yourself in a bottle and you start to sort of push against it and you think, oh my gosh, this is getting really tight here. I should go back to my tiny size again. But then you break away from the bottle and suddenly you think, oh, this is all of my own making. There's real power in understanding the constraints. Constraints are important. It gives you safety. To be able to bend the rules is an important thing to get to new spaces. But we also have to recognize the constraints we put on ourselves, right? That we think, well, I can't create time for something, or I only have 1 minute here, or I need to do things that earn me money, or whatever it is. And all of those things are sort of a damper on well-being. There's this great paper I came across recently by Amy Isham and I think Tim Jackson, and they focused on essentially they talk about flow and all of the activities you can do to experience flow, high degree of flow with very low sort of environmentally impactful sort of things that don't cost much and don't impact the environment much. And they essentially argue against, you know, the fact of materialism essentially puts a real damper on our ability to experience flow and how we can claim flow back. It's important to have flow in order to have well-being. It's important to flow. It's not as simple as making you feel better. It gives you a sense of the power that lies within you, right? There's very few other instances where you can really feel how strong you are or how capable you are, right, in your daily life. It's just sort of things that are surprising to you.
Like daydreaming when we were kids. Like when we were kids, we used to do a hell of a lot more daydreaming than we do as an adult. And that daydreaming was very important to just feeling good.
Yes. And I think it's impossible to daydream now, if you think about it. Like, so when...
Because you take out your phone.
You're taking out your phone. So I think I speak to like my colleagues about this, you know, as someone who teaches at university. And very often what we're trying to do in a classroom is very different from when I was a student in a classroom when there were no phones around, right? Because ultimately, if a lecturer was boring, you would either decide to, you know, you had to either focus and do something like doodling, or you'd focus and take notes. If that didn't work, you'd start to doodle. Or if me, I would generally just go into this fantasy realm, right? In my head, like stare at the person and just zone out.
And that's flow.
That's and it's just nice. It just, you're just off in an imaginative space, really. Whereas now, I think the first thing is to look at your, you know, it's what happens is that all our distractions now push us to being very present, focused, and it doesn't really sort of allow you to know how to deal with boredom. Because part of knowing how to deal with boredom is, and if you're left with your own thoughts, is that you think about things that are in your own mind and not somebody else's mind, right? So if you're going on your phone and you're looking at, oh, what's somebody saying on Twitter or whatever it might be, you know, that you're looking at, it's typically what other people are saying and doing and thinking. It's a very different time now, right?
So, and it's that the closed, like we were speaking there about Donald McKinnon said that we have our closed mode of thinking and the open mode of thinking. And the closed mode of thinking is what we use to socialize, to buy our food, to just integrate with other people. And social media is very much a closed way of thinking, because you're consistently reacting against other people's opinions and then evaluating yourself. So if you look at social media, you can see, you know, someone else has something that I don't have, and then I go, I wonder, should I have that thing? Or I'll see someone who's doing better than I'm doing, and I wonder, should I be doing as good as they are? And all of these thoughts are so far removed from where I need to be creative. And to be creative, I need to be open. And to be open means the ego isn't present and I'm playing for the sake of play. There's very little playfulness on social media.
That's true. There's very little play there. But also I think the importance of coming to your own sort of impressions, right? I mean, it's very hard when you have social media because let's think about, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, when you watch something like the news, right? It would be perhaps once or twice a day. You might listen on the radio or watch television, depending on that. And you just read what was being served to you. And you had time to cultivate your own opinion. You didn't, you might hear perhaps what your parents thought of it if they were, if you were kind of in a vocal family. But even then, not necessarily, but you were sort of, you know, mulling over what you had just heard and read or saw, devoid of anybody else's sort of speaking voice. And so by the time, I think those sorts of things, the fact that it kind of strengthens your own mental, your muscles in a sense, to think for yourself and to form your own opinions or to question. Whereas I think the problem a lot with social media is, I think it's great to have a lot of the opinion. For one thing, you get, you have a wider access to the world and all the worldviews there. But also you don't have really much time for reflection. Because you, your own reflection, your own personal, individual way of looking at things.
Because within seconds, you look at the comments. You look at the comments within seconds.
Absolutely, and it could be from people it could be from people you despise and people you love.
Absolutely,
you know. Yeah. And very often, our feeds or whatever you might be using there are very tailored to people. Most people are not trying to be heterogeneous in their sampling of the world around them. Mm-hmm. They tend to be very homogeneous. They tend to be friends with people, you know, try to follow people they like, listen to opinions that they agree with, and so on. And so it becomes, it's a kind of has a bit of a devastating effect, I think, on your ability to imagine and your ability to think even logically in many ways, and not just imaginatively and playfully or creatively, but also in a critical, logical way, which is the other side, the closed mode side, which is also essential to the creative process. And that is also equally being compromised. And I don't think that gets as much notice because the obvious impact on playfulness and creativity is plain to see. But the other side is that we're not cognitively pushing ourselves in ways that we had to perhaps early on, because there was less information, you had to seek out stuff more. You suddenly didn't have 100 opinions thrown at you, or what you've, you know. And so I think we had to evolve. It does have an impact on the way thinking evolves in general. And
it's interesting what you said there, where you said that. So we've lost the capacity to. So let's just say it's the 90s. You see a news story. You don't have to listen to many opinions. You have time to think about that news story or whatever all day long in the open mode of thinking via daydreaming or boredom. And then you can enter the closed mode of thinking and engage criticality and form opinions. And that's really important. The closed mode of thinking, it has its place. Like what I refer to it as is, if I'm writing a short story, I write with fire in my veins and I edit with ice in my veins. So the process of creativity is crazy. There's no rules. I'm there to have fun. I'm not judgmental. All I want is 2,000 words. But then tomorrow, once I have those 2,000 words, then I don't want to use my open mode of thinking. I want to go back to those words with a critical, closed way of thinking. And in my closed way of thinking, that's where I bring in things that I've learned from the past. I bring in skill. I bring in criticality. I'm a bit harder on myself, but these things are only helpful the day after.
Yeah. I mean, the closed mode really deserves a lot of praise. I think it's because it's less magical in some ways that it gets a short shrift. But editing is so, it's the refining of an idea can make all the difference in, for, you know, it's part of the satisfying moment of, it's not just satisfying to you, but it's going to be satisfying to the larger collective. And that really enters in only at the point of the closed mode and this revision aspect of it all, that you realize, oh, this is a good idea, but I need to go back to the drawing board because I think I can do better. And or the finessing of it is, you know, like we just, you know, it's sort of so important to the process of the aesthetic experience of anything that we do, right? Whether it's creating music or writing or coming up with a theory. So I think the closed mode deserves a lot of you there for sure, because it's
when you polish the rough diamond that you found the day before.
And it's really about looking at it from, how is someone else going to look at this? You know,
yeah.
How do I reach out to my audience? It's not enough that I'm having a frolicking great time, you know,
yeah.
Having these ideas. Also, I kind of want other people to enjoy it, and that might mean tweaking it in specific ways. And so that's why the editing process is so creative in and of itself.
It's creative, but if I think of an audience while I'm trying to enter flow, I'm fucked.
Yeah, no.
That's it. And immediately, that's when I begin to self-flagellate. And that's when I like a big fear that a lot of creative people have is you enter flow once and then you feel it's never going to happen again. And then when you try and do it again, you go, that's it. I'm actually not creative. It was just a fluke. And then you beat yourself up. Yeah. And I'm going to ask you about creative block later, but one thing I want to pick up on. So when you were speaking there about how the modern social media environment has put barriers up for us to engage in kind of a solitary reflectiveness, you're not just speaking there about artists or creative people, you're speaking about the benefit of daydreaming or flow for yeah. all human beings.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about that?
I think the creativity essentially is not the domain of only a few privileged or talented people. Mm-hmm. Some people are very lucky to be born with, you know, clear interests and clear talents and all. That might be in the artistic sort of spectrum of things you could do.
Yeah.
And then they have the right kind of guidance. So it's easily recognized. And those, I would say, are mm-hmm. very fortunate people. But creativity is... For me, it's more like a mindset that we have to think about as well. You know, I'm trying to, in my more recent work now, I was trying to think about creativity as more like creative health, you know. It's just mm-hmm. like, you know, we sort of devote ourselves. So if you think about this a little bit in terms of physical health, like we take this for granted now. But before the 80s, there was no huge pressure on everybody to get fit.
Yeah.
And like it really took, I don't know, Jane Fonda and the aerobics movement. And again,
yeah.
I don't know enough about... these kind of Western cultural trends, but I'm assuming that she was the one to sort of popularize it. And those, and you know, the coming of TV, the showing of people in action combined with fitness
experts. Bodybuilding was weird.
In the
1970s, yeah. there was this film called Pumping Iron, and it's the first film that Arnold Schwarzenegger was ever in. And he was just as a young Austrian bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm.
But this film about bodybuilders in 1973 in California was presented as a novelty. It's like, wow, isn't it so strange that there's these people in California and they're trying to grow muscles? How odd. And now this is just popular culture.
It's just, yeah, God, every place has like a little protein shake shop and stuff, right? Like, I mean,
yeah.
essentially, yeah, but it's kind of mind-boggling how quickly all of that took over. It took a visual medium first that was accessible and there in people's households. Most people could afford it, some level of it. It took, you know, the sports to be broadcasted in very specific mm-hmm. ways. And not sports as in competitive expert sports, but things that you could do at home, things that you could
yeah.
do with a little bit of help. Suddenly, you know, it wasn't just glamorous actresses and models who could be good, you know, have a certain type of fitness. Mm-hmm. It was sort of reachable for everybody. And now, if you fast forward to now, I think you'd be hard pressed to find people who weren't at least aware of what means to be physically
yes.
fit, didn't have certain aspirations there, even if they may not always follow it, and know things about nutrition, how, you know, what kind of activity burns
yeah.
calories and what doesn't and so on. And this is a very, very, very fast evolution. So this concept of physical fitness is a pretty novel one
mm-hmm.
in terms of being accessible. And I think if you want creative fitness, we're nowhere near there, right? Because still creativity is seen in relation to the highest magnitude, right? So it's
And it's seen- also not like, so creativity is valued amongst a small section of society. But if you're not an artist, it's seen as time wasting. And
yeah.
like I always think, we're all born creative. Every single child plays with crayons. Every single child plays with Lego and engages in play and creativity. And then you get to about 3 or 4 years of age, you go to school, and then someone puts you into the category of talented or not talented.
Gosh,
and then
yeah.
some people just stop.
Yeah, I mean, so that's exactly it. So in creativity research, sort of, we would distinguish between what we call magnitudes of creativity, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this very famous model called the 4C model, and you'd say, well, on the lowest end of magnitude is what we call mini-C creativity. And this is what children exhibit every mm-hmm. single day. And they do it through sometimes the arts, like you said, but taking crayons or Lego and so on. But they actually do it through their exploration of spaces. They're making sense of the environment. If you are around little children, it's kind of crazy the way they... The kind of things they say, the kind of sense they're making of their world, right? Or the mm-hmm. questions they ask you really show you that it's a kind of curiosity and sort of, and they would say the really zany things because mm-hmm. That's what. So I can give an example of my son. When he was very young, and he's autistic, so he's less communicative than most kids. Mm-hmm. But he saw that I was putting on some eyeliner, and then he said, "What?" And I said, "Eye makeup is what he would call it." He said, "What about nose makeup?" Right? And I thought,
That's brilliant.
I said, my gosh, if you figure out how that works, we could be gazillionaires in no time. Right? But I was like, that's so bizarre. I've never thought, how could you decorate your nose, essentially? But why not, right? Yeah, but I mean, believe me, I did try to, like, I let him go to town and it looked ridiculous. But he had a lot of fun and I did too. But essentially, it was sort of like, that's such a child thing to say, you know, and they say it all. I mean, kids do it all the time. They're making sense of the environment and they say the most creative things and imaginative mm-hmm. things possible. And so that's sort of like the lowest magnitude in that it's very subjective. It's very, you know, and that's so powerful in and of itself. Next level would be something what they call little C creativity. And this is perhaps mm-hmm. Slightly more objective. So I know, for instance, I do some writing on my own time for myself. And I know, for instance, mm-hmm. that the poem I wrote yesterday is probably better than the poem I wrote, I don't know, 2 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is when you have some sort of level of, so it's a little bit, it's quite different from what a little baby or a little child does. So there's a little bit of objectivity there. And that's mm-hmm. also valuable and powerful to me because it gives me...
So there's criticality there.
There's some criticality there, at least a more, I wouldn't say criticality as much as an evolution that you're aware of, of your own abilities, right? So mm-hmm. I know, for instance, now I'm a much better cook today than I was when I was 20. And that's because I just have more experience. I'm more experimental and trying things, you know.
So it's an awareness of, here's a thing that I've been rewarded in the past. I think I'm good at this. I would like to get better.
Yeah, and also I like to surprise people. I like to surprise myself even, and that I know how sort of different ingredients can be put together to develop a sort of interesting taste. And so it's more like an evolution of your own skills that may or may not be associated with external recognition, right? So in schools they have like competitions, especially arts-based competitions or science-based competitions that try and reward this a little bit, but it doesn't have to be something that is associated with external sort of incentives. And the third level would be the proC, I think it's called, professional creativity. This is mm-hmm. essentially the level to which a lot of people who have recognized, you know, have recognized that they have talent, or other people have recognized it for them and decide to pursue it as more than just a hobby at some mm-hmm. level or degree of professionalism. So these might be the kids who end up going to art school, for instance, mm-hmm. right? And the final level is what's called big C creativity. And these are people who reach, let's say, the pinnacle of creative achievement in that their ideas change the world. Mm-hmm. Right? And not every artist's ideas change the world, right? No, not every mm-hmm. idea out there will persuade you to change your taste in music or writing practices and so on. So it's important to think that when people are at the moment, what I would say is most people, when they think of creativity, are thinking of just the highest or the highest two levels of magnitude mainly, which is professional or big C, if you want, levels of creativity. Mm-hmm. But it all starts, you can't get there without starting from, you know, the rudimentary levels of creative thinking and sort of creative discovery that starts with the little mini C with the children and all the way up. So when I think about creative health, it's almost like when I think, well, none of, see, for me, I will try to maintain my fitness a little bit, doing a little bit of running. I like to run, for instance. I know that I'm not going to be I'm not going to be an Usain Bolt or a Serena Williams, right? Yeah. But that doesn't mean I don't invest in my physical fitness, because I have a body, I have the capacity to move, and my physical fitness is not just about getting good and being the fastest or the best. It's about maintaining, my physical health. It's about all of the other benefits.
And it feels amazing. Like, I run too. And the reason that I run, I run because it feels incredible. And this is a wonderful thing that I do every day. And when I run a lot, this is one of the things that helps me to be creative, that puts me in a position to do it. And that's a wonderful argument you're putting forward there, where lots of people run, and lots of people run with zero expectation of becoming professional runners.
Absolutely.
So why don't we all engage in one of those seas of creativity? Now, the other question I'd have for you is, like, what is the benefit to the human being who would engage in some degree of creativity in their daily life?
There's so many. First is having a sense of, developing a sense of mastery in something, right? So let's take, it can be anything. It can be something that's avowedly creative, like, you know, learning how to paint or something, learning how to, it's trying your hand at writing poems or cooking, anything you want it to be, really. That it's just important that it's a little bit open-ended, so there's room for discovery and room for growth. And I think, so one is, of course, just learning about yourself and your own skills. That's enormously powerful for people to have some ownership. You know, there's very few of us who have complete ownership of what everything you do in your life in some ways. I mean, how many of us really do that? But most of us work for some establishment. You know, we do have to cater to specific rules and roles that particular job requires and so on. The advantage of creative pursuits is that you're kind of your own, I don't want to say your own boss, but essentially it's all about what, you know, I want to do in the moment, what I enjoy doing in the moment. And it's really a process of self-discovery in a sense.
Personal meaning.
It's personal
meaning.
What
I always find is meaning. I mean, a sense of having meaning and purpose, because quite a lot of people don't get meaning and purpose from their work.
They don't.
But a lot of people work jobs, and these jobs are so that they can live and survive.
Yeah.
And I always encourage people to try and find anything creative to do as a way to find personal meaning. Here's a thing I love doing.
Yes.
There's no results from it.
Exactly.
I don't make money from it.
Exactly.
But I'm making space to discover who I am and what I like.
Yeah.
And this then, I find it has a very beneficial impact on our sense of self-worth.
Absolutely.
Because if you have a sense of meaning, then you understand what you know, what you like, you know what your boundaries are, you know who you are.
You understand yourself better, and
it's
interesting that you're sort of casting a lens on yourself in a sort of really reflective, generous, warm, open-minded capacity in a way that nobody else can do it for you. You know, you see yourself progressing, and not maybe progressing is not the way, but the evolution of your skills, the way that you think, you experience flow kind of effortlessly while you do it. There is no one who enters into those spaces of just trying out something and that comes out of it and says, oh, this was awful. You know, it never happens, because if you're not doing it in order to earn money, or if you're not doing it with sort of a productive goal at the end, you know, you're just messing about and you're having fun. And that's enormously, it is enormously rewarding to know that you granted yourself that generosity and that it produced something that at least makes you smile, you know, gave you a sense.
Yeah.
I didn't know I had this in me. Because like you mentioned, when you write, you sometimes think, I didn't know I had that in me. Like it just came out the way it did. And that is a process of like self-revelation there is enormously powerful. It makes you feel a strong sense of autonomy. It makes you feel more in control. Not control in a bad way, but just sort of like less, you know, moving around with the winds of change as much. Like, you know, this is me. This is where I'm solidly anchored. I can do this. Is an enormously powerful thing to have.
We're going to take a slight break from the conversation with Anna Abraham now so that we can have a pause. This week we're going to have... I have a little jaw harp, which is an instrument that you put into your mouth and you play. So let's have a jaw harp pause. I'm going to do this. You'll hear an advertisement for something. I don't know what it is. So here's the jaw harp pause.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Out of my mouth. Nice conclusion. That was the jaw harp pause. I hope you had a nice advertisement there. Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. If you enjoy this podcast, if you're listening to it regularly, if it's providing you with entertainment, please consider paying me for that work that I'm doing. This podcast is my full-time job. I'm only able to do the podcast each week because it's my full-time job. I love the work, but please consider paying me for that work. If you're enjoying it and you're consuming it, all I'm looking for is the price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month. That's it. And if you can't afford that, you know, you might be out of work, whatever. Don't worry about it. You can listen for free because the person who's paying me for my work is also paying for you to listen for free. It's a lovely model that's based on kindness and soundness. Everybody gets a podcast. I get to earn a living. What more could you want? So thank you so much to all my patrons. Also, becoming a patron keeps this podcast independent. I get to speak about whatever I want to speak about. I get to make podcasts that I'm passionate about. I get to put out content that I really want to put out and to be happy with the work that I'm making. And podcasting is becoming very commercialized. There's a lot of money being pumped in from big brands, large podcasts that have celebrities hosting them are taking over the podcast space. So small podcasts are kind of getting inched out. And by me having this podcast independent also, it means that I can choose who advertises on this podcast. And most importantly, no advertiser can tell me what my content should be or edit my content in any way or ask me to change what I'm doing, because if they do, I'll tell them to fuck off. No, you can't advertise on this podcast if you want me to adjust the content. This isn't the podcast for you. Bye bye. So patrons make that possible. So thank you to all my patrons. And also, don't just support my independent podcast, support whatever independent podcast you enjoy listening to. If you listen to a podcast with small creators, one or two people, you have to support these small creators monetarily or simply sharing it and talking about it if you want the podcast space to remain good, essentially. Because if we don't, and the brands take over and the big names take over, it's not podcasting anymore. It's just shit radio with more curses. So thank you for that. And back to my chat with Professor Anna Abraham. For me, it's sometimes if I experience intense flow, the peak feeling, if I could put it into words, is I feel like my existence has purpose. It's like, I know why I'm alive. Everything about being alive makes sense right now. And it's to do this. And it's the most wonderful feeling. It's almost spiritual. I I know why I'm alive. This, it's to do this.
Yeah, it's called peak experiences for that particular reason, right? It's almost like a sense of, I mean, if you look at the kind of experiences that lead to flow, very often, I mean, the highest thing that you can do is the arts and crafts. Mm-hmm. Some people experience it obviously when they're engaged in praying and meditation and things like that.
Yes.
Sort of in, you can also experience it when you're having a wonderful conversation with someone who you really gel with and are having a stimulating, and it's just taking you places. And, you know, and I'm sure you've had those, and your listeners have as well, where you just think, where's the time passed? This has been incredible. I feel rejuvenated. I feel like I have learned so much here. And there's the peak experience side of it. It's a subject of study for so long in psychology, and it's just so magical that it can happen in so many different situations. The reason why we think that it's really important to engage in creative pursuits, particularly nowadays as well, is that it really pushes you away from looking outward into the world that is grabbing our attention all the time, has ways of making us, I don't know anyone who looks at social media and is saying, this is wonderful only, you know?
Yeah, you're hoping you find something funny, but like you have to go through a lot of pain to find that one little funny thing. And
yes.
You wonder, was it worth it?
Was it worth it? And you feel a bit badgered by the end of it, thinking, I cannot believe I spent all this time trying to find that. And somehow just allowing your mind to heal from that experience alone by engaging in different types of activities that, you know, allow you to engage and flow in. And very often the arts and crafts are the fastest, easiest access point in order to do it. But there's, you can do it through sports as well. You know, you can do it through things like just, you know, appreciating nature. Some people get it when they're just riding a bike. It's just like clearing your mind of all of the clutter. Yeah, running.
Running. Yeah. If you get that, what would be referred to as the runner's high.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I mean, that is, you're not present, but you're very present all at one. And it's just fantastic and beautiful. And the runner's high is, it's similar to creative flow. You mentioned meditation there. Is meditation a form of flow?
It can be, depending. It can lead you to flow states for sure, depending on what kind of meditation you do. It's certainly one of the many activities one can do in order to reach a flow state. But so are, you know, so is things like reading fiction very often.
Yes.
You know, it's
getting,
you know,
lost
what
in
it's,
someone else's work is flow.
When you are absorbed in it, you know, that's something else. But the highest
listening
level. It's interesting though that the more passive your experience of, so you can get flow experiences through very passive sort of things you can do. So for instance, this might be sometimes, for instance, people playing video games or watching, like binge watching movies or, you know, programs.
Yeah.
Now this mimics in many ways the flow experience in that it's very stimulating. Yeah.
That's the core word there that mimics.
It only mimics. Yeah.
I play video games. I will binge watch. It feels like flow, but I don't get all that lovely beneficial. I don't feel rejuvenated afterwards. I feel kind of drained, even though I did exit the room mentally and exist in something like flow state.
Yeah. And I think this is what is the other side. So the flow experience is something we experience, you know, this one of those magical things we can experience as human beings. But like all good things, when something mimics many aspects of the flow state, then you're much more unlikely to engage in something that pushes you into an actual flow state, because that requires effort, right?
Yeah.
If I can just turn
drugs?
On. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The same thing.
Drugs will give some people, and some people will, I don't know, smoke a joint and then try to create something and they'll think it's amazing while they're high. And then afterwards, they'll just go, what the fuck was that?
Absolutely.
That's
very
common.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, there's some really elaborate studies in the 60s when, you know, there was still psychedelics were permitted. Not as, you know, they were used for a lot of, there was some really excellent studies that were done. And they looked at artists who were before the influence, while taking it, and after. And you can, they were doing sort of their usual work. And there's no question that it deteriorates during the experience. There's literally, and I think it was Aldous Huxley, who's, of course, experimented greatly and was very conscious about the benefits of certain aspects of taking psychedelics, really pointed this out really well, in that he said, you know, we have to distinguish between what is going on during the experience and how it affects you after. Because during the experience, you're not particularly interested in doing anything productive or useful, you know, and that it's so what you can't actually expect much of sort of creative worth to come out of that, that physically you would produce something while you're in that state. The advantages, if any, to glean from it, from those who have good experiences under, when consuming such substances, is that for many people, it sort of changes the way they look at the world, or they have had a sort of revelation in those moments that change, that essentially affect the way they look at the word from afterwards. You know, so they've had something meaningful has clicked and changed. So it's more about what they leave with the experience rather than what they had during it, right?
Because I think about that a lot, Anna, and so I would think of something like the music of the Beatles in the 60s when the Beatles went psychedelic. Yeah. So yes, okay, John Lennon and Paul McCartney took acid, but... okay, they took acid and they saw some stuff and had some revelations on acid, but then the creativity didn't happen while they were on the acid. It happened afterwards. So these are people who are already creative responding to something that happened. So if you got John Lennon and put him on a bus, something creative is going to happen about that bus trip as much as an LSD trip.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It's just, you know... was it Rilke? It's this great quote where he says, "Don't, you know, you shouldn't complain. And your capacity to be a poet has to do with the way you look at the world. So the if you can't be a poet in your surrounding, it means that you don't, you know, you're unable to capture how gorgeous the world is. It's your powers that have failed you. It's not the world that has failed you, right? And I think it's absolutely true that anyone who is, so yes, I think Lennon would have got... I mean, it wouldn't have mattered, because if you're sort of looking at the way he looked at the world and the kind of music they produced, you can see that it's about a curiosity, right? A playfulness, a curiosity, and openness.
Did you watch the documentary?
Yes, I did.
Like, that is the most beautiful documentary about the creative process.
Yes.
Because we think these songs are, these very important, serious songs that change the world. And then you see how they're being created. And all it is it's friendship. It's friends.
It's humility.
Having fun. Humility.
I was so struck by that. You know, like these are the, they were rock stars, like of the highest order at the point when that was being made. And I just didn't see ego. I didn't see, they were just trying to make things work, and they had an openness and generosity to each other, and of course there were little tensions.
They were so respectful with those tensions. We were led to believe that they were fighting.
They
all loved each other. They all really loved and respected each other, and even though they loved and respected each other, they had their little bickering stuff. And I know they didn't respect George Harrison because he was younger than them and they couldn't stop seeing him as a 13-year-old, but there was love present throughout all of it.
It's just the way they looked at each other, right? It was just, I was thinking, I'm not sure if anything in the modern era would compare to this, because it was so sort of striking to see that in action. And what you could see about the creative process there is that it's a collective effort. You're listening to each other. You're trying to, you're searching for ways in which the magic can happen. And it's both purposeful and completely unplanned at the same time, right? That was so magical about that process, and that it was sort of, it took you both spaces, and you told you that they were really capable of holding out till the end, till they absolutely had to.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really important marker for creativity at the highest level, that you don't try to do things very quickly, as fast as possible to meet some deadlines, but you hold out till you're sure that this is the best you could do in that situation.
And you know what Paul McCartney said recently about that exact thing you're mentioning? So Paul McCartney was complaining about having an iPhone. So Paul McCartney was saying, like, recently, I have an iPhone now, so if an idea for a song comes into my head, I just shout it into my iPhone and I forget about it and I never return. But in the olden days, me and John Lennon, if we had an idea for a song, We literally had to do it there and then. And he said even before that, the most important part of their creativity, when Lennon and McCartney weren't even famous, so they had no access to recording equipment, if they wrote a song together in their bedroom, and they might write six a day, only the one that was the catchiest was the one that they would remember, which I thought was beautiful.
That's amazing.
Because they had no way to record it.
Wow. Yeah. That's very cool.
Isn't it just incredible?
It is just incredible. And it's just, I just love how they sort of fed off each other's, the best, you know, what they were able to produce together. I think they were able to sort of bring out the best in each other, right? That was just sort of, that kind of tells you how the constraints and of the time, like you're saying, of the situation that they had, and how they sort of intelligently dealt with it to bring out, you know, to use their own minds to sort of think, okay, let's go with this particular tactic. I wonder if either of them were alone, that if they would think to do that, if you see what I mean. Like,
no, because the solo work, like, you listen to their individual solo work, and yes, some of the songs are quite good, but they're in their solo work, it's not as strong as the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And one thing too that you see with their relationship, which I feel is very important to collaborative creativity, they had unwritten rules of delegation. So when it came to words, it was quite clear that John Lennon was the man for the words, and everybody respected that. And they would use the phrase good words, which I thought was beautiful. Yes. They didn't say poetic lyrics. It was simply John Lennon saying, just keep saying words, just keep saying whatever word that comes into your head, and then we'll figure out the good words later. Mm-hmm. And then when it came to the music, the symmetrical vibrations of air, that was Paul McCartney's territory. Hmm. And then George Harrison tried to fit in between that double relationship, and there was tension. And then Ringo was just like, I'm a drummer, I'm gonna be the backing beat, and I don't interfere with what you guys have going on because I don't have it. And it worked beautifully.
Yeah, because you need the tension, you need the stability that Ringo was providing as well, actually.
Yeah.
And you need that sort of camaraderie there, the trusted duo to come up with whatever they can. But the tension that I think Lennon, at least I haven't read that much about them, but certainly from the documentary, it was very clear that he was very curious about everything that George had to say and was suggesting. So that is a real openness to change. So imagine you're doing something amazing, and then someone else comes along and says, what about this? It does take you to be pretty egoless to allow somebody else to come in, as they did for who came to play the piano, and that really lifted them up, right?
Billy Preston,
exactly.
And it was a wonderful addition to the relationship, and you could see all their friendships changed as soon as Billy Preston came in. It was just different.
Yeah,
it was like
they
spiced up the relationship. They did something new.
They were so chuffed, all four of them, like, just, you know, just so eager and gleeful about him there. And he was so happy to be part of it. Yeah.
In your field, Anna, because like we're speaking about this film here, and surely within your field, working professionally, studying creativity, that film surely is something that people are speaking about within your field. Because to me, it's like that's a documentary about the creative process, unadulterated.
It certainly is. And I would have to I haven't actually spoken to anyone in the field about it. I wonder if, you know, usually things take time to filter through a little bit.
Okay.
And I imagine that it's the sort of thing that creative researchers from the music side of the research side would be people that would be looking at that much more closely. But it's an incredible resource because, you know, it's very rare to find. I mean, we are living in an age where you get first person narratives from so many artists that is unprecedented, right? So you can I think there must be 20 McCartney interviews out there at different times, you know, over the past 10 years, for instance, and now following this one. But very often, it has a lot to do with who's interviewing, perhaps, and what they're trying to get at, and if someone is trying to find out about their process, or if it's about more a sort of fanboy perspective, maybe. But
I'll tell you specifically, sorry for interrupting.
No, go on.
So specifically about that film and what you're speaking about there. So first of all, people didn't have the awareness of cameras that we have now. right? Now, second of all, and this is why this film took so long to make, a huge amount of the conversations that we hear in that film were actually artificially generated using software. So when the Beatles were speaking privately, often they would try to play their guitars quite loudly over the speech.
Right.
So they put a lot of effort into not being heard or seen by the cameras all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to obfuscate and hide it. But Peter Jackson, the director, got like cutting edge technology.
Yeah, he's a wizard, yes.
to cut out that guitar sound or to do this and to enhance stuff they didn't want us hearing. They never expected that all of those conversations would end up on film. They just thought it would be the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
It's a film for the podcast generation. We're okay with listening to something now that's 3 hours long. We're okay with that. Or hearing an unedited conversation. In the 60s, that was crazy. That didn't happen.
That's true. So talk about forward thinking for the time. But yeah, you never see the creative process play out in the moment. There's almost nothing like that that's sort of unadulterated. The interesting thing about it, though, and I think I was listening to, I forget where, to whom Peter Jackson was speaking, with some podcast, and he apparently spoke about how he presented it to McCartney to say, you know, I've done this thing. And McCartney was a bit nervous. And he said, no, you know what? I just want to reassure you that none of you come out of this looking awful. If anything, it's really surprised. And so he pointed out how in that even the members who were there remembered it as being more negative than it was.
Because of the press.
Yeah. So it just the insidiousness of that at some level, right? That you think, oh, and of course, directly after that, there were, you know, breakups. Things just really happened. It went downhill from there. And so their memory, so I love that the, you know, in psychology, I mean, I think it was Daniel Kahneman who talked about the distinction between your experience of something and your memory of it, right? And that I think I don't know where he came up with this, but he said, your sense of the present is only 9 seconds long, essentially. The experienced present, right? So when you think about, especially in the context of creativity, don't think about engaging in it thinking, how am I going to remember this? Because that is not a proper depiction of what really happens in that moment, right? Like, even if you think about what you did yesterday, you might have had a hard day yesterday, and you think kind of, you're not thinking about the whole 2 hours that you struggled. You just have little moments there. So it's just part of it is thinking your experience of something is quite different from your memory of it, because memory is not linear. It's sort of woven in some way, right? It's not, it's the way you recall things is quite different. And so I thought that was what was really powerful about that documentary in many ways, and it was beautiful to be able to show to the remaining members, at least, that, you know, you're one of the few people who have the maybe not all how many ever hours of the experience, but in condensed form, still very long. You know what the experience of that creating that was and how distinct it is from your memory of it. And now you can, it's a sort of healing process, I think, to know that, oh, you know what, that was a good experience. That was amazing. We were wonderful to each other. We were, and so I think that's kind of, I have some ideas that I'm sort of mulling over about what that can tell us about why we can need to promote sort of creative fitness or creative health, let's say, is that part of doing that is just like with physical fitness, it's about in the moment what you experience is glorious, and we shouldn't think about it in terms of what happens after that. You know, we put so much premium on what is the outcome I get out of things in a very concrete way. And part of it is to really understand the experience of something, that is the outcome. Like that, what you're experiencing in the here and now, that's going to be good. And that's going to be, and when you think about it in the aftermath, you might think, oh, that half an hour, I should have been doing X. And that's the sort of thing that gets people to not do it, right? Because they're like, oh, I wasted my time there. I should have done this instead. I should have, you know, and to think, no, actually, you're then discounting what actually happened in that half hour that you used to engage in that specific creative mode. So that's something to be perhaps a little more mindful of, is perhaps the word, you know, in.
And that for me as well, personally. So if I write a book, it takes me about a year, and it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
And when the book ends and when it gets to publishing, that's really sad. I don't like that part.
Yeah.
It reminds me a bit of death. It just, it feels that. But one thing that I've found is, in order to help my, to engage in flow more, is I need to create because the experience of creating is the reward, not the end piece.
Yeah.
The actual joy of doing it. And if I'm doing that and I'm in flow, the end piece kind of looks after itself. The end piece will be good if I'm there. But, and it's the same with exercise. Like, I exercise because I enjoy exercising, not because I'm trying to grow more muscles or lose weight. That stuff will happen anyway. But process-based creativity has been something that's really beneficial to me. This process is hugely enjoyable. And if I do this, I'm happy for the rest of the week and I have high self-esteem.
Yeah, and that's really the way to, I think that's a good analogy to the book, writing of the book and finishing it. And there is a real slump point that comes when, and it somehow feels very divorced, the writing process and the publishing process.
Is this it?
Yeah.
Is this it?
And it is, I think when I wrote the first thing, the first main, and it's also true if you write research articles sometimes, you know, by the time it gets accepted and stuff, you're so beyond, once you see it, it's, the process has been sort of a struggle, but I do remember when I wrote the book that I did, Neuroscience of Creativity, it was quite painful to write it. It was also very joyful to write it. But I absolutely was unprepared for how divorced the actual coming out of the book would be. And I thought in my head, why doesn't this feel more momentous, you know? And that's because we are so outcome focused. We expect to feel like perhaps as we did when we were kids, if you won a race or something, you got a little prize and the outcome was very close in, you know, physical time and space to the doing of the thing. And a lot of good things in life that require, you know, just attention in a specific way, dedication over a long period of time, especially the written work. Now, written work is really unusual because it takes, I've talked about different types of creativities, and I talked about how creative writing is an essentially a fragile process because every aspect of it is in isolation, right? You have the ideas in isolation, you're writing it by yourself. All of that publishing stuff happens completely divorced from you. When it comes out, people are reading it and they have to read it by them. So it takes time at every single step. It is an exercise in isolation in some ways, right? And requires a lot of time and effort from everybody. It's very different if it's music because you create something and you kind of go out and play it in front of a crowd, for instance, or even
and you
just
get to relive that. Yeah,
exactly. And they feel it because the attention required for anything visual or musical is instantaneous, right? So you can, if you want someone's attention, you just click your fingers, you got it. Whereas if you're trying to get them to read a book, even if you throw the book on their heads, they're not going to read it, right? They have to actually engage in a different process. So there are real differences in the process of, you know, in the creative process, depending on what domain you're looking at. And so I would think that if people want to get into doing more creative activities, they probably want to pay a little attention to that as well, that some things come, so the process of discovery is faster, I think, if you're on one hand, for instance, writing, we've all been trained to write and we, you know, we don't read, so you have an upper hand there, right? You can already start, so you could start with little, I don't know, limericks if you want, but or little haikus.
Say to people to journal.
Oh yeah,
just speak about, write about your day. And if you want to throw that in the bin afterwards, that's okay. But just write about your day for you and you only. And you're not looking for an end result. You're writing about your day for the joy of doing it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That's completely something that would be simple to do in terms of, yes, you're recounting something. If you want to try and create something new, you can also do it at a smaller level, right? Start with something small, a format that is small. It could be a little sketch. It could be anything.
Or a coloring book.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people use that for rehab as
well. People who are scared, people who are frightened. A lot of people are terrified because they think, I'm not creative because a teacher told them years ago. And the first thing they feel safe to do is to use a coloring book because they know I can't go outside the lines because the lines are already there.
Yeah.
And it's an okay first step, I think, for someone who's frightened.
I think it's confidence. Important to, you know, I think there's a real, again, the process of discovery of materials that you can use. Like visual arts are really great that way. Like is whether it's coloring, it's just if you're trying to color with different types of materials, right? Whether it's chalk or whether it's a crayon or whether it's a pencil, it has a different effect. And there's something about doing it that is a process, a mini process of discovery, perhaps, but the feel of the drawing implement against the material that you're using is kind of fascinating because it's not something you kind of, and you can see that with kids, you know, when you give them something that they're not used to, suddenly like, oh, this feels different. This is interesting. This is coming off of my fingers. That is, there's, I think people just need to sort of realize that the joy of discovering something that was unexpected, right? That there is something, and this is why something like gossip or something might be interesting for us. Again, this is mimicking the process of discovery. But ultimately, it's because we're primed to enjoy discovering, to novelty, to discovering something new, to making new connections. And it can be exploited our attentional systems can be exploited in ways that are counter to our own interests by, you know, as you see sometimes with social media and so on. But ultimately, it's there. It's, you know, it's there for a really good purpose, which is noticing. And then the thing about drawing is that you start to notice things. When you start to notice, we do these sometimes when they do these workshops, we do drawing exercises where we tell people to draw the same thing. But then first we give them like 30 seconds and then we give them I don't know, 2 minutes and then give them 5 minutes. And every time they do the drawing, of course, and every time they just look at the object differently, they're noticing more details. They notice angles and little shadows. And when people are talking about it, they're just so much joy in just seeing things anew. And so these are sort of things that are in anybody's grasp, you know,
and what you mentioned there as well, Anna, is actually quite helpful. So, if you'd say to somebody, you know, you set up a still life, you know, a vase and some fruit, and you say, draw that, that can be very frightening to people. But if you say to them, draw that in 60 seconds, people are more willing to do it because...
It's playful to start with, anyway.
It's playful, it's fun, there's restrictions. And the thing is, too, you know, if someone says to you, draw that in 60 seconds... you know the end result is going to be shit anyway. And when that is the case, the fear of failure isn't there. And it's one of the first exercises. When I studied art college, when I went to art college, we would have a still life model in the class. Mm-hmm. And that's very intimidating. Draw this human and everybody else is drawing the other human and you're going to compare how good each of your drawings are.
Yeah.
But the first class was, we have this person is going to change poses every 5 minutes. And you have to try your best to describe what you see every 5 minutes. And once that happens, you stop worrying about what's good or bad very quickly because the parameters have changed and then you're entering flow easier.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter. It's more, in some ways, you become more practical about it. Mm-hmm. And so that removes all inhibitions. And it just becomes like, oh, this is a game. And games are great. Like it's a little, it's not about right or wrong. It's not about skill. Really, somehow, it's more about
fun.
It's about fun, right? That's
why. And curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Or write a poem in 60 seconds.
Yes.
Like you're saying, you know, you enjoy writing poetry, but sometimes, you know, block can come in because you're concerned about, oh, this has to be good.
Yeah.
But if someone says, write a poem in 60 seconds, then that's it. Like I do a thing at the moment. I use a website called Twitch, which is a live streaming website. And what I do is... I play a video game on Twitch, but I also have musical equipment with me. So I try and write as many songs in an hour as I can to the events of the video game. And what this does is it's impossible to fail because what I'm doing is making songs for the sake of making songs. And no one expects them to be good because the parameters have changed. He's writing songs about a video game live and... it's process based, and that for me is wonderful because I get an hour of flow every week that makes me just feel wonderful.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can see that, you know, you found a way to do something that's within your grasp and not the main thing about creativity is that whenever people say not everybody's creative and people need to realize, A, they're talking about another magnitude. They're talking about the level mm-hmm. of, I don't know, Einsteins and you know, people who you recognize as having clear artistic talent. And that the reason we think everything is so out of our reach is because of that. Like your teacher might have told mm-hmm. your teacher who knew nothing told you you couldn't draw. But the main thing is to realize that you're being robbed a little bit of the simple pleasures that you can give yourself at zero cost. The simple pleasures that give you just so much benefit in terms of, A, just improving your mood, giving you a more positive sense of yourself, and to do things that are in your grasp. And sometimes it might help to have people around. So some people, you know, people do, again, back to physical fitness, people train better sometimes with friends, right? Like they go out and, mm-hmm. and do something like that.
Charades.
Oh, yeah. That's such fun.
That's creativity that we all engage in. It's very enjoyable. There's no right or wrong, but you're expected to think laterally in the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's just, another situation where you have very little time. You're thrown into a situation where you have to make sense and deliver, like do something meaningful in a very short period of time. And it doesn't matter if you make a fool of yourself or, you know, it all of that just goes. So if you know what the constraints are that are preventing you from doing something, then try to work around them or find ways in which you can diffuse the situation so mm-hmm. that it becomes really more about just people having fun for themselves.
You mentioned earlier autism. And I'm currently going through the diagnosis for autism in my 30s. There's a lot of things about how I relate to people, how I think my specified interests may well be on the autistic spectrum. So I'm going through that process at the moment.
Okay.
And one thing I'd like to ask about, and a lot of people on the internet asked about, is there a relationship between people who are autistic or ADHD or neurodivergent and creativity?
Gosh.
Is there a relationship between those two things? And have you seen it in your work?
Yes, I have. But yes. I have to always be careful when we say these things. But
of course.
Essentially, because of course there are so many ways in which one can be neurodivergent and these sort of, it's important to understand that these classifications change very often. Sometimes they become so loose so as to be either not. I think we've gone from an era where nothing was really recognized properly to everything is being recognized almost too soon sometimes. So there are issues mm-hmm. with how we come to recognize and classify and give labels. And so that's important to be aware of. So a lot of our research that might be quite old, you have to keep in mind that the current labels may not, you know, like they might be a little different now in terms of how you would examine it. But so the link between, it's kind of how I got into creativity is because I was very curious about the association, you know, the madness creativity link. And I sort of wanted to, I was always interested in mental illness. I'm not mm-hmm. sure where that stemmed from, but I think part of it was that I did a lot of volunteer work when I was an undergrad. I was around a lot of people, even growing up, who was clearly there had, you know, issues. But mm-hmm. I did notice in that there was something about certain groups where it was clear that there was another side to the story, but it was just my impression. I mean, when you read any, you know, it's an age old sort of link since, you know, ancient Greece, the idea that there's an association between certain forms of mental illness, like I think they focused very early on depression was the big thing mm-hmm. then that they focused on, and creativity and so much. And a lot of it was because the creativity was really seen as a gift from the gods in some sense.
Yes.
And that, I mean, the reasoning behind it kind of keeps changing over the ages, but very often you could be, you know, you could get both sides. You could get the gift as well as the curse, which mm-hmm. is you get to see the truth, but no one's going to understand you. So you're going to be tortured your entire life. So there was this idea that sort of like what we experience in the flow state very often, that this is coming from within, but also not within. And it's just coming out there. I'm seeing things that I never thought mm-hmm. possible. A lot of the ancient cultures attributed this to spirits outside oneself, right? And gods and so on. So in some ways it took away from the pressure one felt when trying to create, because it was not inside you, it was outside you. I think Elizabeth Gilbert talks about this in great detail, about how artists a long, long time ago had less stress as a result, because it wasn't about their genius, it was about being sort of the genius.
A conduit for God.
Yes, absolutely. And so with that came other things, that conduits that are there, that are the things that would like push you into perhaps developing mental illnesses and so on. So my work sort of looked at schizophrenia mainly, but also ADHD. And of course, I've read a lot about all of this in this field, and I write about it extensively. So what matters is that, so first of all, there's no simple relationship, I would say. It's a very chicken egg situation, because it's very clear that some in our modern society, again, I can't speak of, you know, how things were looked at earlier, but let's say in the past 50, 60 years, when we look at data from there, we can say that there are interesting trends that are remarkable and that can't be swept aside. So there's a lot of sort of birth registry data from Scandinavia. They have systems where they record essentially all your information from birth to death. So you can find out what the average birth rate was, or the birth weight, sorry, was of child's children born in 1950, whether if you were born in the winter compared to the summer, where there was more likelihood of certain types of, you know, diseases occurring, premature births, so on and so forth. So they have these huge registries that allow you to examine patterns in data. And so there was, I think Simon Kiaga is his name, does most of the studies in relation to creativity using birth registry data. And he has a ton of papers now on this, as well as a book, I think. And he found that, so he looked at if you had a specific mental disorder, like schizophrenia, were you more likely to be in a creative profession? Was your parents more likely to be in a creative profession? Were your siblings, and so on and so forth? So not just you as, not just the person itself, but also their relations. Yeah. And what he found was that unipolar depression was not associated with any higher likelihood of being in a creative profession.
So what is unipolar depression?
That means, that means just sort of acute, severe depression. So the comparison was between bipolar disorder, depression, and schizophrenia. Those were the three major severe mental disorders that he was focusing on. And what he
So is unipolar depression like the depression that somebody would get because they're speaking negatively to themselves or because of life events rather than something happening in the brain?
No, I think it's a latter, because it's sort of, it's usually would be linked to some form of neurochemical insufficiencies. And very often, you know, is associated with suicide. It's really acute depression that is very, very, it's a very severe condition, and it's very common. And so there's no association. So the age-old link between depression is probably one of the reasons to look at this. Is it was not found in relation to depression in the modern era, at least. But there was an association with bipolar disorder. So if a person was more likely to be in a creative profession, and all their next of kin, first degree relatives were more likely to be in a creative profession if they had bipolar disorder. In the case of schizophrenia, it was only the advantage, if you want to call it that, only extended to your next of kin in the first degree, but not to the person suffering themselves, right? So that you have, so you have these association data that says, well, that's interesting. So then you have the other side of the coin, which is to say, well, a lot of the time when people are suffering from these sorts of, you know, severe conditions, what happens is that you might not be in the position to get the kind of other sorts of jobs. You're much more likely to go into artistic professions because other jobs are not open to you.
Yeah.
And so that's why I said it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, that you're not sure if it really gives an advantage on the creativity side, or whether it's a matter of, well, no other professions are open to them. A third thing, of course, is that these professions are very hard professions to be extremely successful and productive in. These are very, very, you know, a creative professional is someone who has to deal with a lot of instability. They're more likely to have part-time jobs. They're much less likely to have like, they're much more likely to be swayed by anything that happens in the economy. So in COVID, for instance, absolutely tanked the creative arts pretty much all over the world.
And you got to be in the top 10% to get recognized.
Exactly right. It's brutal, the competition. So those kinds of stresses are huge risk factors for developing major mental disorders as well. So there is, that's again another one of these chicken and egg things. Like, if you're, is it being part of that profession that leads to these issues? And there is some, I forget his name, really early evidence looking at sort of trawling through sort of historically creative periods, right? So when people look at the Renaissance, for instance, it was a kind of unique period for the arts, because artists were treated very, very well, could earn very well. And there were sort of interesting ways in which the arts were commissioned. So for instance, if they had a competition for, well, we want to put a sculpture in front of this building and we're going to get 10 artists to work on it and submit their work, and one person will win. The person who won still won, and only their art went, but all the artists were paid.
Yes.
For their efforts.
Very important.
Right?
Paid for effort, yeah. So for me personally, over the past 2 years, lockdown was terrible for my creativity, specifically because of what you mentioned there, spontaneity of speaking to a stranger, because of what that would do to my creativity, and when I was stuck with the same four walls, that's the last question I want to ask you, Anna.
Yes.
What is creative block? What does it look like from as someone who studies creativity? Creative block is a huge enemy to me, and when creative block happens, I'm not just not creating art and not accessing flow, but my mental health suffers massively if I can't create.
Yeah.
What is creative block?
Well, a block is usually when, well, it's just an obstacle to your ability to be generative in the manner that you want to be generative, whether it's composing a piece of music or writing. Or I think block happens less in the visual arts than it does for writing. And I think that's it, just because with visual, you can mess around. You might be unhappy with what you're producing.
Process.
The process is immediate and direct, and you can get into it. But with music as well.
Writing, that's why it's called writer's block.
Exactly.
Writing is Jesus Christ. Yeah. If I get block, I'm not writing, and it's very hurtful to sit down and for no words to appear, or for the words that do appear to be ones that come from my closed mode of thinking.
Yeah.
As soon as I think about block, then I'm in the closed mode. I'm critical and I can't access flow and I feel terrible.
Yeah, and I think this is what I was sort of saying earlier. The creative process is different depending on the specific practice that you look at, right? So creative, so blocks definitely is something that writers experience. And I think even songwriters do at sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? So,
especially when they need that next hit.
Yeah. Oh, I can't. I mean, I just look at songwriting and think this must be really hard. So a lot of like great songwriters will write about, let's say, the struggles that they experience or whatever. And then their whole life changes when they get really famous or very good.
Yeah.
And suddenly you have less access to a lot of the source material that you would normally have access to. Were you struggling, you know? And that must be that I see is that there might be different reasons for blocks happening. And for if in the case of songwriters who especially get to be very, very successful, you occupy a different space now. That is a space of comfort from which it is much harder to have.
And a space of adoration.
Adoration
is very dangerous.
Adoration
is very dangerous. And that's someone
Cobain in particular.
Kurt Cobain in particular. That was a huge issue.
He was being adored,
and he was being deserving of that adoration. Deserving really hurt him, and it hurt his creativity.
Yeah, and I think people said your sensitivity gets blunted, and people who are very aware of the creative process, this can be torture for them. And I think with writing a book, and so it's much, much worse, because it's just the task in front of you is so enormous, and you can't mess around as much as if you're a songwriter. You can still try to like stimulate your senses by playing on an instrument or go, you know, things like that, trying to get together with people and just have, you know, have a bit of a jam session or something. You can try to trick your way out of it. With writing, it's less so.
I try automatic writing.
If I'm really stuck, I'm typing and I'm not thinking about what I'm typing, and that's when I'm typing up a guitar.
And the work of Alice Flaherty is probably the most. She's written a great book called The Midnight's Disease. It's all about creative block. And the opposite.
Oh, lovely.
The opposite, hyperlexia, which is the incredible drive to want to just write. Like every waking moment you have, you know, to spend, even if it's a minute, people who have hyperlexic will tend to start with, it's just a state-based thing. It's not really a, it's not, mm-hmm. it's not like people suffer from bouts of hyperlexia. And she has this theory of creative motivation and about how, so, and she experienced it firsthand. So it's a great book because it really captures what a block is like, what hyperlexia is like, and how both can be incredibly painful things to go through, and how it has to do with sort of the brain systems that are involved with creative motivation, and how dopaminergic systems and so on. And she gets mm-hmm. into it. It's a sort of a poetic scientific book, which is very rare to come across, but it's this thing about the drive, even if you're hyperlexic, it's not that you're necessarily writing anything that's good. It's just that you have this, you're just spurting out words because you need to talk. You need to get that all mm-hmm. out of your system. There are very famous cases of writer's block, right? Like, so who wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Very famous for being, what's his name? Arthur? Arthur?
Bollocks.
God, yeah. But this is embarrassing.
We know
this is embarrassing. Yeah, but okay. I'm just blocking on names today. So he was renowned for his writer's blocks, and so much so that his publishers would like lock him into mm-hmm. like a hotel room for a month on end, and then he'd be required to produce pages.
Douglas Adams.
There we go, Douglas Adams. I knew there was an A in there somewhere. It's very hard to know what to do about it because it is very individual how to get over mm-hmm. it and so on. So you found things that work for you. Very often it has to do with just the kind of pressures one puts on oneself in order to produce, you know, the pressures you might
for
be feeling.
It's my ego.
The most harmful thing for me as a creative person is
any form, both positive and negative critique are deeply harmful.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
If I release a book and a bunch of people say, "This is amazing, I loved it." If I take that praise on and I start to internalize that as part of my self-worth, then it's a double-edged blade. Then the criticism, the negative criticism hurts as much.
Yeah.
And I know my creativity and my flow only comes from within. I have to write the book that I would want to read if I wasn't me. And if I try and create for anybody else, I will get blocked because I can't create for anyone else. It's a solitary act, and it has to do with me and my sense of fun and play. And being a professional artist is very difficult because your work is critiqued both positively and negatively. So switching that off is a long, tough process that requires a huge amount of self-care.
Yeah, it's very hard to, A, not be drawn to the positives and also not to be drawn to the negative. Like, one can get very stuck on...
And one negative comment will... I could see 1,000 positive comments in that one negative comment.
One negative comment will...
And that's common. Every artist says that.
Absolutely. And because it's... Especially with writing,
and that's common. Every artist says that.
Absolutely. So much of your blood, sweat, and tears into it that it feels any kind of act, and it's an act of generosity, writing, I feel like, when I look at it, it's just like you are being generous with your thoughts and views to the world, and the sort of slights that can come in your way have a way of knocking people off course. And sometimes you can get so off course it's very hard to find your way back, and it's a very slow, painstaking process to try and get your way back. And usually the kind of things that I read about is, A, to first figure out what it is that's the obstacle. And in your case, as you said, it's your ego gets in the way, and the ability to deal with that. Then figure out a way to try and avoid that. And ultimately, it's about setting structure for your practice, which is
hugely
showing up to work, which is show up 100%. To your table, sit down, even if it's just an hour or two, at some point it should be consistent.
Like, I got myself an office. I got myself an office.
Oh, see, that's great.
Literally, like,
there is a place that I go
to
9 to 5
as if I'm an office worker,
as if I'm an office worker.
Where I create.
This is where
that's what I did, and that's what I did, and that's
to get back
into a place where I can write and enjoy it and feel like fun, because nothing else happens in this space other than not creativity, but the act of trying. Because if I go in there and say, I'm going to create today, then I won't. But I can always say, I'm going to go into this office and today I will try.
Yeah.
And trying is very important, because trying has no outcome. It's just process based.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think John Cleese really talks about this really well, I think, in terms of how to set up a practice. And you identify getting a space in which you can work is a really important thing. And I'm trying to think of all the things
and then
he points.
It's space, time, and time is there twice.
No, because space is there twice, or is the time is there twice? Yeah, maybe time is there twice. I forget.
Yeah, no, it's space once and then time twice, because time is so important. Because once you set up the space to create, you have to tolerate the anxiety of not entering flow. And that's where you have to, in order to go from the closed way of thinking to the open way of thinking, that's what requires the time. So it's the ability to tolerate the frustration.
Exactly. So leave it for as much time as possible. Carve out a space and time. So a consistent a space where you can write, for instance, a time in the day, either every day or every 2 days, whatever works, that works. And then stick time. The third time is stick with it as long as you can till you absolutely use all the time you have available to work on it. I think he also emphasizes playfulness and humor.
And fun. And no solemnity.
No, yeah, I love that. It's just like...
The solemnity is beautiful, because you don't think about solemnity, but it's so true. Yeah. Solemnity fucking destroys everything. And he also points out that solemnity serves no purpose.
It really doesn't.
It's true. It only serves pomposity and power.
Absolutely.
Because if you look at where solemnity is most present, it's most present in religion, the judicial system, the military. These are all very solemn spaces where humor is not allowed.
Yeah.
So solemnity has no place in the creative process.
Yes. And I mean, I couldn't agree more. And it's interesting for me that he's, you know, as a practitioner, he's come up with the best theory of the creative process, I think. And it's also thinking when you're blocked, you have a lot of anxiety. It's very hard to get into a space where humor is possible. So even when you carve out the space and time for yourself, the pressure, because when you're trying to write, you're saying, I don't want to put pressure, but you are feeling pressure and you are feeling very humorless about the whole thing. And so somehow to try and work your way into feeling lighter, you know, that's really important. And for different people, it's different things. And I think for me, whenever I'm in a space where I'm feeling like I'm being really uncreative here, or I'm just not, I'm being too solemn, I'm being too hard on myself, I'm just not being in a, I try to, literally, this is when YouTube comes in handy for me. I would watch something that makes me laugh. And usually it's comedy. Mm-hmm. It's usually stand-up comedy because it's sort of smart and witty and funny. And it just snaps me out of that funk that I might be in.
Yeah.
And it's just a temporary, it's a little like lift before I get started on something, which is, again, it's nice to see people doing something creative. And so something like comedy, especially stand-up, is extremely smart. If it's done well, it's extremely smart. It's extremely wise. It's extremely funny. And it's extremely creative all in one. And there are very few situations where you can get a lot of, what is it called? A lot for very little. So for me, that's sort of something I do, because I'm writing a book now and it's an excruciating process because I have no time to really devote to it. And very often I'm like, okay, I know this can work, and I really enjoy the moment when I'm really writing well and feeling it. There's nothing like it, you know, when you're really in that state of flow, or when you're thinking, oh, this is an interesting insight to bring across, for instance. But to get there, I have to it's like letting all of the, you know, you feel a bit straitjacketed, and it's like opening out all those buckles, like letting yourself loose, letting the muscles stop being tense and just be loose, breathing a little bit. A lot of people will do sort of some form of guided imagery before, because they can't get out of it. And, you know, there are lots of apps, a lot of them are free, I think, online, where you can sort of do a 3-minute sort of get out of my headspace, Anna. Get out of your own headspace. Yeah. allow things to happen. So I think for it's very individual. What might work for one will not work for another.
So I've added an extra step to John Cleese's process. So
oh, damn it.
After fun, I try to fail. So if fun isn't working, I deliberately try to fail because it's the fear of failure and my own ego that's preventing the creativity. So I think of the worst idea I can possibly think of and I go with it.
Yeah.
And that's what works for me.
It's quite genius.
And then
yeah.
if that fails, I go back to the surrealists and I use random input.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I'll use cut up techniques or I'll just go into Google Images and look for random images
yeah.
and allow the computer to feed me random inputs and I just try and create at these random inputs.
Yeah.
But trying to fail, that's very important. Like literally, what's the worst thing I could do right now? What's a terrible, awful idea? Let's do it. Let's write about that because that's what I'm scared of. Let's do it. And often, some of my best ideas come from, like I wrote a short story about a girl who moves to Barcelona and she becomes legitimately convinced that her next door neighbor is Donald Duck. And I was just going, that's terrible. What an awful book. What a terrible book. And I did it. And I was so pleased with the end result. I was thrilled. I was like, wow, this is really creative. This ticks all my personal boxes. And it's a 2,000 word story about a girl who thinks that her neighbor is Donald Duck. Only because I did that, that I end up with that story. Because I'm like, that's fucking stupid. What a silly idea. Let's do it.
Yes, yes. That's great. I think what you mentioned about associativeness is important. Like if you can push yourself to connect unusual things, even a little exercise like that, it kind of loosens your associative strengths of your conceptual yeah. networks. And that's also hugely helpful. And I have got to read that story because it makes me chuckle thinking about it.
Thank you so much for your time there, Anna, because we're 2 hours there.
Oh, wow. Gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was such a wonderful conversation. I learned tons about creativity, but just speaking to you as a person, it was just such a lovely, lovely conversation. And thank you so much for that.
I really have enjoyed this. So thank you for having me on your show.
So that was my chat with Anna Abraham. Check out her stuff at annaabraham.com. I'll catch you next week. Maybe I'll have a hot take. Just to let you know, there'll be no Twitch stream this week. I'll be back next week because I am working this week away from my studio, so I can't do my Twitch stream. Dog bless you all. I hope you have a wonderful rest of the week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.